This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, we'll be talking about the pain of commuting when infrastructure is in bad shape. Have you been stuck in a highway congestion or on a delayed train recently? Give us a call to complain. Our number 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, or tweet us at Science Friday, at SCIFRI. But first, you can say that my next guest is an expert in extreme animal behavior. He's researched the snap of a crocodile's jaw. He has studied the voltage discharge of electric eels. He even knows about something called worm grunting. But among his favorite research subjects, the star-nosed mole takes the prize for most extreme adaptations. We're talking Guinness Book of World Records level stuff. For example, its eponymous nose, like a fleshy pink starfish sticking out of its head. You have to look at this to see it, and it's the most sensitive organ of any mammal ever. And studying them has given us a peek into the way the human nervous system is mapped in the brain. Ken Catania is Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University. Welcome back to Science Friday, Ken.
Hi, it's great to be here again.
This is one of the more odd-looking creatures. Describe to our listeners what they look like.
Sure. So this is about a mouse-sized little mammal. So it's not all that big, but the front of its face has these 22 appendages on it. So that gives it this really bizarre look. And since it's a mole, it's also got these big clawed forelimbs. So those two things put together really give it a bizarre appearance.
You know, but a lot of moles have tiny eyes. They rely on touch. How did the star-nosed mole come to have this specific adaptation?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story, and it kind of has two sides to it. One would be, you know, how did this thing evolve? And the other is, why did this thing evolve? The how did it evolve is really interesting because it looks like the evolutionary sequence is played out in the development. So if you look at the embryos, they are amazing looking morphology where mm-hmm. the star sort of unfolds off the face almost like a sort of a flower petal coming off the sides. And that suggests, and we have other evidence for this, that this thing evolved from sensory strips on the side of the face rather than growing out as straight appendages. The how it evolved is in the wetlands, there are a huge resource of little soft-bodied things that this animal can eat. And in order to do that, because these things are small, it has to have high sensitivity, high acuity, and be really, really fast.
We know that its nose, as I said before, is the most sensitive organ of any mammal. Give us an idea of how sensitive it is.
Well, that's interesting because we actually have not been able to measure the lower threshold for force that will cause activation of these nerve endings. So they are extremely sensitive. There's a couple ways you can think of sensitivity. One is sort of compression that would cause a nerve to fire. Another way is to look at the receptive field size, and they have microscopic receptive fields. And a receptive field is basically what's the size of the skin region that one nerve will respond to. So that's sort of like the pixels in a camera. Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly high-resolution touch organ, so it gives them a great picture of what's going on in their world.
How much resolution is it? Can you give us an idea?
Well, there's 25,000 of these little tiny touch domes on the star, and there are 100,000 nerve fibers that are supplying these things. So to give you a good sort of comparison, a human hand, which we know is a very sensitive thing, has about 17,000 touch fibers, and the star is only the size of your fingertip. So imagine five times the acuity and sensitivity of your hand compressed to the size of one fingertip.
Wow. So it's like something that your retina, close to that kind of sensitivity? So
yeah,
sort of like a retina at the front of its face?
Absolutely. I think that's a great analogy. The star is just completely made of sensory organs stuck out there on the nose. I use the word amazing probably too much when I talk about this animal.
You look at the animal, there's nothing short of amazing about it. And they hold a world record too, don't they?
That's right. And, you know, we were originally studying their behavior to look at how they move the star around. And in order to do that, we had to get a very high-speed camera and film that 1,000 frames per second just to see what was happening. And when we published these results, I got this phone call and we discussed how quickly they were eating. And a little bit later, I realized this was the Guinness Book of World Records, and they sent me this nice certificate in the mail. Of course, I sort of joke. I took my PhD off the wall and put the Guinness Book of World Records certificate up there instead, because it's just so much fun to have that. Mm-hmm. So they can eat something in about – they can decide to eat something, snap it up, and continue searching for the next thing in about 200 milliseconds, so a fifth of a second.
Wow. Wow. And the other thing they use these special noses for is – they can smell underwater. Isn't that unique, too?
Yeah, it's just one surprise after another with this animal. So we filmed them underwater thinking maybe they wouldn't be, because they dive, they live in wetlands. And so we thought maybe this would be sort of less efficient underwater. Well, it's completely the opposite. We discovered that they're actually sniffing by pushing out air bubbles onto things and re-inhaling these air bubbles as a way to collect odorants, as a sort of a workaround to use olfaction underwater, which nobody had believed was possible for mammals. So really interesting discovery.
Well, it does sound like there's a lot of stuff yet to be discovered, and you're the guy to do it, I think.
Well, thanks.
What other things would you like to know? I mean, you're looking at it because I'm sure the nerve fibers are interesting to you and how the brain works, right?
Yeah, so the brain is a really interesting area in this species because, you know, one of the big goals of looking at how brains are organized is to look at how these sensory maps are laid out. And usually that's a pretty difficult thing to determine, even though we have a lot of technology to do this now these days. In star-nosed moles, you can actually see a star in the neocortex. So where the star information projects into the neocortical layers, there's a star pattern there. And as soon as we saw that, we realized there's one part of the star pattern that's disproportionately large, and that turned out to be a touch fovea. So they use the star the way we use our eyes, moving around this little sensitive area for high resolution and sort of scanning with the other parts of the star. It's very analogous to a visual system in that behavior. So kind of a unique animal in that sense as well.
I know I mentioned something earlier that I have to get to because I have to know. I have to ask you about another area of your research, which is worm grunting.
Yeah.
Worm grunting. So my listeners heard me say it correctly.
Yeah, it's not something the worms do. This is a bait collecting technique that has been done in the Southeast for decades. And it's always been a mystery. So basically what is done is a wooden stake is pounded into the ground and you rub it with a piece of metal and literally hundreds or thousands of big earthworms come out of the ground. It's an amazing thing to see. And so the question has always been, you know, this is one of those mysteries that I love. Why on earth would these earthworms do this? And all the way back to Darwin, there was speculation that maybe they interpreted vibrations as digging moles and this was an escape response. And so sure enough, I went down there and hooked up with some of the worm grunters, Gary and Audrey Revel, who are really wonderful people who are doing this as a way to make a living. And together we explored this question, and it's very clear that the moles in the area, these aren't star-nosed moles, these are more common moles, are creating vibrations, and rightly so, the earthworms are terrified of them and come to the surface. So it's a lot like the arms race between bats and moths, which you may have heard of, but it's happening underground.
Well, we have a lot of videos on our website. We have the moles. We have the worm grunting on our website at sciencefriday.com/mole. Is there anything else you want to know about this mole? What I want to know is, can I find one in my backyard if I want to look at this mole? How common is it?
Well, they do live in much of the northeastern United States. They live in large areas of New York State. We collect them mostly in Pennsylvania. They are fairly common but rarely seen. So imagine if you had moles in your lawn and you wanted to go see one in the morning. That'd be pretty hard. Translate that to a swamp and you kind of get the idea of why it's so challenging to see them. But you might see one sometime. Most likely if your cat brings it in, unfortunately.
Hey, so they're sharing like the underground real estate with the other moles and rodents that live under there.
Yeah, yeah. So when we do the field work, we set out hundreds of traps, and more often than not, we're catching other animals in the same tunnels that the star-nosed moles live in. Little shrews that have tiny body size, maybe 3 grams, and tiny brains. We get weasels, which are the top predator in the area that are down. Those are beautiful animals, and they're down there eating the moles and anything else they can catch. voles, sometimes snakes and salamanders. So it's a fascinating ecosystem that honestly we know almost nothing about what goes on in terms of the pecking order and how they interact. So that would be a really interesting thing to expand
on. Do you think there's stuff yet to be discovered underground?
There's always something new to discover. And I have to say, I can never predict what it's going to be. I usually discover something completely unexpected in whether it's a star-nosed mole, an electric eel, worm grunting, and so forth.
I know you've been on Science Friday before, and we've always enjoyed you having you on.
Yeah, so the last time I was on, I should say they told me I really needed to get a landline, and we were traveling for the holidays, and so the idea was to stop at a hotel. And so I walked up to a somewhat stern elderly woman behind the front desk at the time, and I said, with my wife next to me, "Hey, I need a hotel room for an hour." And that really did not go over very well.
We don't do that kind of thing here.
That's basically what she told me. There was no recovering. I had to go to another hotel and start off differently and say, well, I have a radio interview to do. So that's one of my favorite stories about that experience.
Yeah, we're always happy to provide you with any excuses you need to go out hunting or collect research, because we believe in that kind of stuff. Well, find something new, Ken, and come on back and tell us about it, because you're always, got some great stuff to share with us.
Well, thanks so much. It's in the works already. I'll give you a hint that it'll be shocking. It'll be shocking.
It will be shocking. We had you on about something shocking before.
Yeah, there's more to come.
There's more to come. Can't wait. Ken Catania is a Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University. If you see a guy on the ground, look for stuff. That'll be him. Thank you, Ken.
Thanks so much.
As I say, we have the mole video and the worm grunting there down at sciencefriday.com/mole. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, have you been commuting lately? Have you been going through the nightmare of the commute? We're going to be talking about our aging infrastructure and what it's doing to our attempts to just get around. So go to our website and tell us about your experience. Also, send us a text or get on the line and tell us if you had a nightmare today or this week. We're glad to hear from you. Stay with us. Be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. How has your commute been lately? Is it smooth driving, an easy, busy ride, a seamless train journey? Well, in New York and other places, it's been a little rough. From ongoing signal problems and maintenance delays to a power outage that snarled a half a dozen subway lines last month to the growing nightmare that is called Penn Station. The New Jersey Transit Authority will even write you a note for your boss if a delay makes you late. I was stuck on a train the other day, delayed because of an electrical issue. Got to Grand Central, where not one but two escalators were on the fritz. And they were the up escalators, of course. But it's not just we New Yorkers. One line of the Metro in Washington, D.C. shut down yesterday morning after smoke was spotted in a tunnel. Not an unusual occurrence, I'm told. Atlanta residents know what I'm talking about. At the beginning of the month, an overpass on Interstate 85, one of the main routes into downtown, it caught fire and collapsed. The repairs are due in another 6 weeks. Lisa George, a reporter at WABE in Atlanta, walked to the scene of the disaster when it first happened. Lisa, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
You walked to it. It was that close.
It was. As the crow flies, about a quarter mile between our station and where 350 feet of highway went down.
Wow. So how does the fire take down a whole highway overpass?
Well, that's still a matter of debate. What was stored under the highway were 2 to 3 dozen giant wooden spools that had what's known as high-density plastic conduit under it. Now, how that fire started is a legal matter at this point. The allegation is that someone set fire to a chair or a sofa that was on top of a shopping cart under this underpass, and that it smoldered till it caught the conduit and the spools on fire. So it was really the heat that brought the highway down, not the fire itself.
So Atlanta wasn't exactly an easy place to get around before this.
Exactly.
And now you have the fire and the bridge is out.
Yeah. And by the way, I-85, this is just north of downtown Atlanta where this happened, just before I-85 merges with I-75. So we're talking a major route in and out of downtown Atlanta with more than 200,000 cars going across this overpass every day.
So how people are adapting? Are they just spending more time commuting? Are they staying home? Are they telecommuting?
All of those things. Public transit ridership is up an average of more than 10%. In the first couple of days after this happened, it was up 25%. And many businesses, including our own here, WABE in Atlanta, have shifted their working hours, or in the case of the newsroom, it's now if you don't have to be in the newsroom, then work from home if you can. And in the first few weeks, school systems and even municipal governments switched their working hours for a while.
So how is this dealing out in the politics of the city? Are people saying, you know, the city should have been better prepared for this kind of incident?
Well, actually, everybody's got a pretty good sense of humor about it. I mean, we have traffic problems here all the time anyway. So everybody's pretty prepared to spend an extra half hour in the car or to find a new route. One of the few problems has been that the surface streets in the Midtown and Morningside areas of Atlanta, the residential streets, they're getting a little clogged up with people using their various traffic apps and finding new ways through. And those people are posting signs asking for no through traffic to come through.
So you'll just have to grin and bear it, as they say, until that bridge gets fixed.
Exactly. And they're saying June 15th or before, and there's more than $3 million on the table for the contractor if it finishes early.
And we'll just have to wait and see what happens. Thank you, Lisa. Lisa George, reporter for WABE in Atlanta, and walked to the scene of the disaster when it was first happening. Thanks again for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. President Trump has pledged $1 trillion, he says, to repair crumbling infrastructure. No details on that. Congress has yet to weigh in. But engineers have been studying the decaying landscape for decades, and that's what we're going to talk about with some engineers. Martin Wax is Professor Emeritus of City and Regional Planning and Civil and Environmental Engineering at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs in Los Angeles. And Andrew Herman is Partner Emeritus at engineering firm Hardesty and Hanover, past President of the American Society of Civil Engineers. They both join us from Boston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I imagine you were listening in on that, Andrew. Where do the troubles in Atlanta fit into the general state of our transportation infrastructure?
Yeah. When that fire broke out in Georgia, it was quite the heat that brought down the concrete girders and also took out some of the piers. But you're asking about the infrastructure condition across the country?
Yeah.
Well, ASE, as you know, puts out a report card every 4 years, and our latest report card covered 16 categories. We had 12 Ds, 3 Cs, and 1 B for an average grade point of D+. And our roads and our public transit received two of the lowest grades. Roads got a D, and public transit got a D-.
Is there a common theme to why all of this Ds and D-? Let me ask you, Andrew, and then ask you, Martin.
Well, basically, it's the lack of investment in our infrastructure and the lack of maintenance and repair funding to keep it, the infrastructure we have, in good shape. So when you don't take care of the infrastructure that you have, it tends to wear out faster than if you're doing the normal maintenance and rehabilitations you should be doing.
Martin?
I would agree with what was just said, but I would also say that a national report card for something as complex as a highway system can only be a broad signal as to what we have to do in each particular facility, in each particular metropolitan area. The condition can vary very greatly from a national average like that. So we really have to pay attention to this at the state level, at the regional level, at the local level, as well as at the national level.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring in some listeners who can add some flavor to this, and we can talk about what they're seeing. Let's go to Lee in Springfield, Virginia. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
So I'm in Springfield, Virginia, which is part of the Metro Blue Line. And rather than working on the infrastructure involving, like the trains, I mean, we're working on SafeTrack and things like that. But most recently, they have decided to paint all of our stations white. We have a very brutalist concrete station design, which never looks dirty. And rather than changing out our lighting and making sure that our electrical is up to standard and making sure that our light bulbs work, they decided that the way to make a brighter, well-lit station was to paint them all white.
All right, let me, Martin, Andrew, is this a common complaint you hear?
Martin, I don't know. This is the first time I've heard of a complaint like this. I guess white will make it a lot brighter and maybe save some electricity, but I'm not sure how that goes in with the appearance of dirt on it in a subway station.
I certainly think that we should be concerned with the aesthetics of our stations as well as their condition, but I'm not sure that painting is a major infrastructure decline issue.
You're saying that it every region has a different problem of its own, if I heard what you were saying before.
Yes.
How do you decide who is bleeding the most, and what is the politics of why these things are happening?
Well, the politics is enormously different from region to region. So, for example, in New York, when the Penn Station issue arose, there's also the PATH, the Port Authority Trans-Hudson system. There are buses that go into the Port Authority bus terminal, and there are highways, and people can choose among all of those. And the use of information via the radio or information via your smartphone, can help you optimize your travel. But in New York, the interesting thing is that all of those systems are ancient and crowded. So the Port Authority bus terminal is in need of replacement. The PATH system is at capacity. The highway system is congested. So New York has an aging system, and it's hard to add capacity to it in a very highly dense built-up environment. Los Angeles, by comparison, is building billions of dollars worth of new rail to add on to the system that it has, which is relatively incomplete because it relies primarily on highways. So that's what I mean when I say it's different in different regions. Los Angeles building a new rail system and New York having to renew a very old and very expensive system.
Andrew, did you want to chime in on that too?
Sure, especially in the New York City area. You've had decades of underinvestment in that Penn Station terminal. It's very congested, it's crowded, you have a number of lines going in there, and it's very difficult to do the maintenance that they have to do. I mean, even when they were trying to get another tunnel under the Hudson, that's been slowed down and hopefully will be coming in the future. But if they have more access, they can't do some of the maintenance they have to do. Right now, they'll have to shut down some of the tracks to do that.
I have a tweet from Lydia in Florida. She says, you're looking for commuter complaints? I-95 in South Florida is the best place to begin. It's a 24/7 rush hour traffic with nonstop construction.
I think some people in Washington, D.C. area would dispute that it's the worst, but it's all around the country. It just depends on the times of day and the transit that's available.
To me, one of the biggest challenges here is the question of governance. The federal government isn't going to solve all of these problems in every region without active participation from the states and local governments. And so in the New York area, for example, when the two governors are in a dispute over whose money should be building the tunnel under the river, it takes longer and longer to make a decision. And the federal government isn't really motivated to contribute greatly to it unless the states are on the same page. So one of the biggest issues that holds us back is our inability in a democratic system to come to consensus relatively easily on these complicated issues.
Yeah, but the President Trump said he's going to unveil a plan to invest more than $1 trillion in infrastructure, and that would include the roads and the bridges this summer.
It's interesting. When we did our report card put together, we also put a cost of what we need to invest to bring our grades from that D up to a B. And over a 10-year period, we're looking at over $2 trillion. So the $1 trillion would start, but it wouldn't completely help us.
And it would have to be matched in the New York area or the Atlanta area with contributions from the state and the local governments. It would have to go through environmental clearances. It would have to go through citizen participation processes. So just making the commitment is a wonderful start. But the process that we have set into law in our society remains very complicated, and it'll be quite a while before the $1 billion can be seen in improved performance.
A trillion dollars.
Yeah.
That's just a matter of 1,000 times more.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about investing in infrastructure is that it has an economic advantage. When we came out with the report card, we took a look at what would happen if we did invest that $2 trillion yes. over the 10-year period and what it would actually cost. And we found out that the gross domestic product would decrease by almost $4 trillion, and business sales would be lost in the tone of about $7 trillion. So it's amazing what that $2 trillion investment would pay back, yet we're still having political squabbles over it.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Martin Wax and Andrew Herman about the infrastructure. And I have a tweet here coming out. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Randy in San Antonio. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you, Ira.
Mm-hmm.
Here in San Antonio, there's talk of expensive programs to beef up infrastructure like light rail and such. But here we have developers that have had their way for many decades. They get concessions for cheap land, and then they put in hundreds of homes in any one setting. They sell the homes, take the money and run, and then we never hear from them again. The cul-de-sac spaghetti networks that they put in have few ingress and egress points, and they're overburdened and jamming up the adjacent thoroughfares, usually with unintelligent traffic lights that become a dependency. So I think that if they would continue to build the cul-de-sacs, that they should be held accountable for the infrastructure, such as perhaps flying lead intersection ways so that the thoroughfares are not interrupted.
Okay, there you go. So it's not just things that are crumbling, but it's city planning that could be a problem.
In many cities, there is an emphasis on smart growth, as they call it, which is transit-oriented, which is older-fashioned grids rather than cul-de-sacs. But it's absolutely true that while we're doing smarter development in the centers of cities, the suburbs are still growing at the edge in the fashion that we became used to in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to fixing the crumbling infrastructure, is it basically we just, you know, there are taxes for gasoline taxes and different plates and different states have different ways of paying for transportation. Is there a simpler, you talk about how complex the rules are and the system is there a way to simplify it? So something gets done.
It's interesting to talk about gas taxes. If we just raised our gas taxes a quarter a gallon, we could raise a number of funds and help the Highway Trust Fund. And that quarter a gallon would only result in maybe $100 per year for a driver who drives 12,000 miles. Yet the cost of him right now driving due to poor roads can be anywhere from $350 to, in California, I think it's over $850 per year. So another $100 would start saving some money because we'd have easier and better roads to drive on.
Hmm.
Yes, California is actually raising the gasoline taxes by as much as 17 cents a gallon. We're right in the process of it now. The first increase goes July 1st, and then there's another one November 1st. But I think the statement is absolutely correct that it's a very productive investment in that it produces economic returns that exceed the costs. Yet nobody wants their gas tax raised. And it was very hard for the governor to get this through the legislature. So it's always the same story. People want the benefits that come from the spending, but they don't want to pony it up. And I believe, and I think many of us in the transportation field believe, that it's more equitable, actually, to charge the user through gas taxes and tolls than it is to charge the general public through income taxes and sales taxes, because the people who benefit should be paying the costs.
There you have it. Sounds like it's going to get worse before it gets better. I want to thank my guests, Andrew Herman, past president of the American Society for Civil Engineering and partner emeritus at engineering firm Hardesty in Hanover, Martin Wax, professor emeritus of city and regional planning and civil and environmental engineering at UCLA. Thank you both, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
After the break, we're going to talk about Richard Garwin, a scientist who had had a hand basically in creating everything from touchscreens to the hydrogen bomb. Joel Shuchman, genius is the name of his book. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What is the common link between the touchscreen on your smartphone and GPS and MRI machines and even the hydrogen bomb? Here's a hint. It's a person. The basis for all of these technologies can be traced to the research of one scientist, the physicist Richard Garwin. And to folks of a certain age, his name could be heard in the corridors of the Pentagon, Capitol Hill, and research think tanks across the country. For the rest of us, we really have not really heard much about Richard Garwin, but Joel Shuchman is here to change all of that. Arguably, Garwin's most significant design was the one for the hydrogen bomb, which he came up with as a consultant at Los Alamos in 1952. And since that time, he has advocated for the disarmament of the nuclear weapons that he helped develop. And along the way, he has worked for IBM on different technologies that we use every day. And this prodigious problem solver, as I say, is the subject of my guest's latest book, True Genius. I called it genius before. It is true genius. The life and work of Richard Garwin, the most influential scientist you've never heard of. Joel Shuchman is also part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning team of journalists at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And a longtime friend of mine, Joel, welcome to Science Friday. Enrico Fermi, who was a big thinker himself, reportedly called Richard Garwin the only true genius he had met. What? Why?
Well, apparently he was. It's extraordinary coming from Enrico Fermi, who was known in physics as the Pope because he was never wrong. And one day he walked into a luncheonette at Los Alamos and said, "I've just met the one true genius." And everybody at the table thought he was talking about them. They said it was Richard Garwin.
In fact, let me play a clip. We spoke with Richard Garwin a few weeks ago over the phone, and this is how he described how he began working in Fermi's lab.
Well, I went for graduate school to the University of Chicago physics department, but I'm an experimenter, and my fingers itched. I wasn't in a laboratory, and I decided I would go to Professor Fermi. I asked his secretary. He gave me an appointment. Fermi didn't need thinking. I thought he could use help with doing.
Thinking but not doing, Joel.
Well, Garwin grew up in a family. His father was very handy. He ran he was a projectionist and ran a company that fixed movie projectors. And he taught both him and both Richard and his son Edward, who also became a physicist, by the way, how to use their hands, how to blow glass, and do all sorts of things. So he's very handy to have around.
So what type of work did Garwin do for Fermi?
He worked on his dissertation, which has to do with gamma rays. And if you push me any farther, I can't go because I'm not sure I actually understand it.
Well, we all know that one of his biggest projects was working on the first hydrogen bomb. How did he get involved? Was he invited in, or
he was invited. Yeah. He was invited. He spent the summer in Los Alamos as a postdoc. And one day, Edward Teller walked into Fermi's office, and Fermi and Garwin were both there. And Garwin sort of innocently asked, you know, what's going on? And Teller told him what was going on, and Garwin offered to help. And Teller sent him to the library, the classified library, and told him what documents to look up and to go off and to build a test that they could run just to prove that the hydrogen bomb would work. There were a lot of scientists who didn't think it would work. Instead, he came back with the design for the bomb. He said he had been wasting his time just coming up with a test. So he came back with what was very largely the first hydrogen bomb, which was called Ivy Mike.
How come the title of your book is the most influential scientist you've never heard of. Why haven't we heard of Richard Garwin?
Personality. There was a woman whose name I've just forgotten, I just blanked out on, who wrote a book called The Visible Scientist, and she characterized the kind of scientists that you always read about in newspapers, and he filled none of those categories except that he had a steady job. He was not interested in self-promotion. He did not know how to give interviews. Still doesn't, by the way. He knew how to put himself in front of reporters in a handy way that reporters would come back to. And he just didn't do it. He wasn't interested.
You're his biographer now, but you as a journalist, I remember. We all must have covered Richard Garwin back in the day.
I didn't.
You didn't cover him.
Nope, I never heard of him.
So that's why the name of your book. Because I was in Washington. I'd heard of Richard Garwin, you know, because maybe it's because I was in those halls where he used to hang out at the Pentagon and Congress.
Exactly. That's right. He testified in Congress hundreds of times. He was the bane of the Pentagon's existence on any number of projects. He was a science advisor to a half a dozen presidents. So in Washington, he was extremely well known. Yeah. Outside of Washington, not so much.
And he became very vocal. We're talking about the hydrogen bomb, not using nuclear weapons. In fact, let me play a clip in which he describes then what happened.
I became involved with people in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who were not only interested in technology, but in the defense against the missiles. And I understood, you know, what many of these hydrogen bombs would mean. And there I decided that it would be a lot better if they weren't used, a lot better if they were impossible to build. But if I hadn't designed it, somebody else would have, probably within the year or so.
And he still thinks that way about nuclear weapons?
Yes. You'd also added that the bomb they'd come up with would be more expensive than the one he designed.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I get from reading the book and the biography there that he would just go into a project, get it done, and then move on to the next thing.
His theory was they came up with a problem, I solved it, they paid me, and what they do with it is their problem. And that has always been his philosophy.
And he did write a letter to President Trump about the Iran nuclear deal that was signed by many other scientists, right? How did Garwin view that disarmament problem, and how did he get all these scientists to sign that letter?
Essentially, he viewed it as better than nothing, that it had advantages and there was no disadvantages. The advantages outweighed the disadvantages. He got the other scientists to sign it, and only one refused, by the way, Steve Weinberg at Texas, simply because he was Dick Garwin, and everybody knows that he knows what he's talking about. He knows more about nuclear defense than probably any living human, and he's known for that.
And he's still doing work? He's still active? He must be, near 90, something like that?
Actually, Wednesday was his birthday, and he was 89 years old, and if you're listening, happy birthday, Dick.
Oh, was his advocacy work for disarmament spurred by his work on the hydrogen bomb? Does he have any regret about building it? You hear quotes about Oppenheimer. What about Garwin?
That is the good question, and the one I spent most of my time trying to answer, and the answer is I don't know. He says he does not have a guilty conscience. He said if he didn't build it, somebody else would. It was an interesting scientific problem. I asked his children whether they thought his father had a guilty conscience, and they said no. His wife also says no. Plato said that an unexamined life is not worth living, and Garwin disagrees. He has never gone profoundly into the question whether his work on disarmament was because of his work on a hydrogen bomb. He says it is not. The book has been criticized because I did not go deep into his soul to find out whether that's true or not. After spending several years dealing with the man, I think he is what he says he is. There is no relationship. A psychiatrist might disagree, but I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a biographer.
What you see is what you get when you talked about him. Our number, 844-724-8255, talking with Joel Shurkin, author of True Genius, The Life and Work of Richard Garwin, the most influential scientist you've never heard of. Let's talk about some of the things that made him so famous. Give me an idea of some of the things that we use today that we didn't know he had a hand in.
Well, he had a very interesting and quite a wonderful job. He worked for IBM for all his adult life. The arrangement was that he would work two-thirds for the corporation, and he headed a number of their research labs, and one-third for the government. In almost all cases, the work he did for his government was classified, so not anybody, including the chairman of IBM, knew what he was doing or where he was going. In his research, he did such things as develop the first touchscreen, which IBM never made use of, the prototype of the first ATM, which IBM also never made use of. He invented the non-impact laser printer, which they did make use of. And things like that. His handiwork is in almost every satellite. He's probably most famous in defense for his spy satellites, which he can't talk about. So we have absolutely no idea what it was he did with the spy satellites, but he helped design them. And that includes, I believe, the ones that we use for GPS in your car.
Wow. Richard Garwin talked about his work with Jim Levine, one of his colleagues at IBM. And we have a little clip. He describes in this clip their work on one of his favorite projects there, which you touched on.
So we invented several touch technologies, the first of which I like most, which was a laser-scanned input device. And we built it into the first IBM color monitor on the IBM PC in 1981 or thereabouts. And you could use your finger or a stylus or whatever and point to a tenth of a pixel accuracy and draw at whatever speed you like. And Jim Levine programmed up, airline ticket issuing terminals. And we built a couple hundred smart lecterns. And so we had a lot of fun, but I couldn't persuade IBM really to pick it up and go with it in a big way. And so we published our work, and it was there when other people, I guess, had the gumption, Steve Jobs, to put it all together into the iPhone as all the technologies developed.
Yeah, when you work for a giant company, they do not like to take chances on things.
He once got into a fight with somebody at IBM on whether or not the touchscreen would be rejected because it would leave finger marks on the screen, and people wouldn't use it because they didn't want to see the finger marks on the screen. So it got down to that. He did not enjoy corporate science very much, but it was a good, well-paying job. He was well-respected, and he did get to do lots of things that he really did like to do run into people like Jim Levine.
Yeah, did he suffer fools gladly? I mean, did he?
No. The answer to that question is no. It's hard. When you walk into a room and you're the smartest person in any room you walk into, it gets really difficult after a while.
Well, let me go to the phones. We have in Washington, D.C., Brett, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I haven't read the book yet. I'm looking forward to reading it, but I just want to let everyone know what a great mentor he was to younger people. I was younger at the time, and he sponsored me on a couple of different efforts. And he just took a lot of time and patience, because as you mentioned, he is always the smartest guy in the room. But I don't think he gets enough credit for how much time he spent mentoring people in national security in particular. He was just a great, just a wonderful mentor in my experience. One of the, actually the best I've probably had.
And what made him so great is that he took extra time to mentor you. He was careful.
He was careful. He was deliberate. He sponsored me for the Council on Foreign Relationships membership, and he took a lot of time, and he was thorough about everything he did in doing that. And but it was not an easy mentoring. He had a lot of questions, and but he was very positive but challenging. And I just found that a really nice combination.
Well, thanks for calling, Brett. We're talking with Joel Sherkin about True Genius, the life and work of Richard Garwin, the most influential scientist you've never heard of, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Joel, that doesn't surprise you, I imagine.
It surprised me a little bit. He always lamented the fact that he had very few graduate students, and he told me he paid very little attention to them, or less attention than he should have paid to them. So I detected some regret about that. Mm. So the fact that he did mentor some, which I'm sure is true, is good to know.
Oh, how does he view the role of scientists in society? You know, we're going through the marches with scientists and scientists speaking out. How did he view that role?
Well, he goes back into the 1950s, and in the 1950s, scientists were still gods. They had invented the atomic bomb. They ended World War II, and science was very greatly influenced, or government was very greatly influenced by the generation of Los Alamos scientists. And then with the Vietnam War, it started turning. There is a long history in America of anti-intellectualism, and you're seeing it now full-blown. So science is much less powerful, much less influential than it used to be, for various reasons. For one thing, most every department has its own scientists and science advisors. You got some presidents who are interested in science, like Kennedy and Eisenhower, actually, and some who have no interest in it whatsoever, like the one we have now. So he's witnessed the diminution of influence of science in Washington and laments it.
Yeah. Does he think about bigger ideas about the role of science, like we see automation, the problems with people losing their jobs to technology? Does he still think about things like that?
I didn't ask him that question, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. We're going to have him come on, Joel, and maybe sit in with us and we'll talk to him.
I highly recommend it. Dick's problem, and I say this with great love and affection, is that if you ask him a simple question, you will not get a simple answer, although he's getting better at it. He's got so much stuff in his head, just walking around, it's hard to get a simple answer. Also, he explained to me once, a lot of the stuff that's running around in his head is classified, and he is always afraid that he's going to say something that he shouldn't be saying. So you may find him asking you to give the questions ahead of time. He's not doing this to be a rotten guy. He's asking that because he wants to make sure he does not say anything he shouldn't say. He knows all the secrets.
Stuff that's 40 years old, still classified stuff.
Right. Even the titles of some of the stuff are still classified. In my book, I have one paper that the last three or four words are classified. I found out what they were and published it, naturally. But they'll even classify the title of papers, which doesn't really tell you anything about the paper. The one he did on a hydrogen bomb is still classified.
Wow. Thank you, Joel. Great book, True Genius, The Life and Work of Richard Garwin, the Most Influential Scientist You've Never Heard Of. Joel Shurkin, author of the new book. Thanks for taking time to be with us today, Joel.
My pleasure.
Good luck on the book. One last thing before we go. Early explorers like Lewis and Clark could forage on the fly, but how would you live off the land, let's say on Mars? The Sci-Fi team got a backstage look at some of the ways NASA scientists will be prospecting for resources on other planets, and you can check it out at sciencefriday.com/livingoffmars. That's sciencefriday.com/livingoffmars. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great commute home tonight. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.